This is Audible.
Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Call It Courage by Armstrong Sperry. Chapter 1. Flight. It happened many years ago, before the traders and missionaries first came into the South Seas, while the Polynesians were still great in numbers and fierce of heart. But even today, the people of Hikueru sing this story in their chants and tell it over the evening fires. It is the story of Mafatu, the boy who was afraid. They worshipped courage, those early Polynesians, the spirit which had urged them across the Pacific in their sailing canoes before the dawn of recorded history, not knowing where they were going nor caring what their fate might be, still sang its song of danger in their blood. There was only courage. A man who was afraid, what place had he in their midst? And the boy, Mafatu, son of Tevada Nui, the great chief of Hikueru, always had been afraid. So the people drove him forth, not by violence, but by indifference. Mafatu went out alone to face the thing he feared the most, and the people of Hikueru still sing his story in their chants and tell it over the evening fires. It was the sea that Mafatu feared. He had been surrounded by it ever since he was born. The thunder of it filled his ears, the crash of it upon the reef, the mutter of it at sunset, the threat and fury of its storms. On every hand, wherever he turned, the sea. He could not remember when the fear of it first had taken hold of him. Perhaps it was during the great hurricane which swept Hikueru when he was a child of 3. Even now, 12 years later, Mafatu could remember that terrible morning. His mother had taken him out to the barrier reef to search for sea urchins in the reef pools. There were other canoes scattered at wide intervals along the reef. With late afternoon, the other fishermen began to turn back. They shouted warnings to Mafatu's mother. It was the season of hurricane, and the people of Hikueru were nervous and ill at ease, charged, it seemed, with an almost animal awareness of impending storm. But when at last Mafatu's mother turned back toward shore, a swift current had set in around the shoulder of the reef passage, a meeting of tides that swept like a mill race out into the open sea. It seized the frail craft in its swift race. Despite all the woman's skill, the canoe was carried on the crest of the churning tide, through the reef passage, into the outer ocean. Mafatu would never forget the sound of his mother's despairing cry. He didn't know then what it meant, but he felt that something was terribly wrong, and he set up a loud wailing. Night closed down upon them, swift as a frigate's wing, darkening the known world. The wind of the open ocean rushed in at them, screaming. Waves lifted and struck at one another, their crests hissing with spray. The poles of the outrigger were torn from their thwarts. The woman sprang forward to seize her child as the canoe capsized. The little boy gasped when the cold water struck him. He clung to his mother's neck. Moana, the sea god, was reaching up for them, seeking to draw them down to his dark heart. Off the tip of Hikueru, the uninhabited islet of Te Koto lay shrouded in darkness. It was scarcely more than a ledge of coral, almost awash. The swift current bore directly down upon the islet. Dawn found the woman still clinging to the pareu pole and the little boy with his arms locked about his mother's neck. The grim light revealed sharks circling, circling. Little Mafatu buried his head against his mother's cold neck. He was filled with terror. He even forgot the thirst that burned his throat. But the palms of Te Koto beckoned with their promise of life, and the woman fought on. When at last they were cast up on the pinnacle of coral, Mafatu's mother crawled ashore with scarcely enough strength left to pull her child beyond reach of the sea's hungry fingers. The little boy was too weak even to cry. At hand lay a cracked coconut. The woman managed to press the cool, sustaining meat to her child's lips before she died. Sometimes now, in the hush of night, when the moon was full and its light lay in silver bands across the pendanus mats, and all the village was sleeping, Mafatu awoke and sat upright. The sea muttered its eternal threat to the reef. The sea. And a terrible trembling seized the boy's limbs, while a cold sweat broke out on his forehead. Mafatu seemed to see again the faces of the fishermen who had found the dead mother and her whimpering child. These pictures still colored his dreams. And so it was that he shuddered when the mighty seas, gathering far out, hurled themselves at the barrier reef of Hikueru, and the whole island quivered under the assault. Perhaps that was the beginning of it. Mafatu, the boy who had been christened Stout Heart by his proud father, was afraid of the sea. What manner of fisherman would he grow up to be? How would he ever lead the men in battle against warriors of other islands? Mafatu's father heard the whispers, and the man grew silent and grim. The older people were not unkind to the boy, for they believed that it was all the fault of the Tupapau, the ghost spirit which possesses every child at birth. But the girls laughed at him, and the boys failed to include him in their games. And the voice of the reef seemed pitched for his ears alone. It seemed to say, "You cheated me once, Mafatu, but someday I will claim you." Mafatu's stepmother knew small sympathy for him, and his stepbrothers treated him with open scorn. "Listen," they would mock, "Moana, the sea god, thunders on the reef. He is angry with us all because Mafatu is afraid." The boy learned to turn these jibes aside, but his father's silence shamed him. He tried with all his might to overcome his terror of the sea. Sometimes, steeling himself against it, he went with Tavana Nui and his stepbrothers out beyond the reef to fish. Out there, where the glassy swells of the ocean lifted and dropped the small canoe, pictures crowded into the boy's mind, setting his scalp a-tingle. Pictures of himself, a babe, clinging to his mother's back. Sharks cruising. And so overcome would he be at the remembrance of that time that he would drop his spear overboard or let the line go slack at the wrong moment and lose the fish. It was obvious to everyone that Mafatu was useless upon the sea. He would never earn his proper place in the tribe. Stout Heart. How bitter the name must taste upon his father's lips. So, finally, he was not allowed to fare forth with the fishermen. He brought ill luck. He had to stay at home making spears and nets, twisting koi, the husk of the coconut, into stout shark line for other boys to use. He became very skillful at these pursuits, but he hated them. His heart was like a stone in his breast. A nondescript yellow dog named Uri was Mafatu's inseparable companion. Uri, with his thin coat which showed his ribs, and his eyes so puzzled and true, he followed the boy wherever he went. Their only other friend was Kivi, an albatross. The boy had once found the bird on his lonely wanderings. One of Kivi's feet was smaller than the other. Perhaps because it was different from its kind, the older birds were heckling and pestering the fledgling. Something about that small bird trying to fight off its more powerful fellows touched the boy's heart. He picked it up and carried it home, caught fish for it in the shallows of the lagoon. The bird followed Mafatu and Uri about, limping on its one good leg. At length, when the young albatross learned to fly, it began to find its own food. In the air, it achieved perfection, floating serenely against the sky, while Mafatu followed its effortless flight with envious eyes. If only he, too, could escape to some world far removed from Hikueru. Now, once more, it was the beginning of the season of storms. Men scanned the skies anxiously, watching for the dreaded signs which might spell the destruction of their world. Soon the great bonitos would be swimming beyond the reef. Hundreds, thousands of them, for they came each year at this time with the unfailing regularity of the tides. They were held to be the special property of young boys, since it was by killing them that a youth learned to kill the swordfishes and tiger sharks, progressing from one stage to a higher. Every boy in the village sharpened his spear, tested the shaft, honed his shark knife. Every boy, that is, except Mafatu. Kana stopped one afternoon to watch Mafatu at work on his nets. Of all the youths of his own age, Kana alone had been friendly. Sometimes he even stayed behind when the others were fishing to help the boy with his work. The bonitos have begun to run, Mafatu, Kana said quietly. Yes, the other returned, then fell silent. His fingers faltered as they flew among the sennit fibers of the net he was making. My father brought back word from the reef today, Kana went on. Already there are many bonitos out there. Tomorrow we boys will go after them. That's our job. It will be fun, eh? Mafatu's knuckles whitened. His ears pounded with the swift fury of the sea. That will be fun, won't it? Kana insisted, watching Mafatu closely. But the boy made no answer. Kana started to speak. He stopped, turned impatiently, and walked away. Mafatu wanted to cry out after him. Wait, Kana, I'll go, I'll try. But the words would not come. Kana had gone. Tomorrow, he and all the other boys would be taking their canoes out beyond the reef. They would return at sunset, loaded down with bonitos, their faces happy, their shouts filling the dusk. Their fathers would say, See, what a fine fisherman is my son. He will be a chief one of these days. Only Tavananui would be silent. His son had not gone. That night, a new moon rose above the edge of the sea, silvering the land with a bloom of magic. Wandering along the outer beach with Uri, Mafatu heard laughing voices and drew hastily into the black shadow of a pandanus. A group of boys were pulling their canoes above high water mark and laying their plans for the morrow. Their voices were shrill with eagerness. Tomorrow, at daybreak, one was saying. There'll be Timi and Tapu and Viri. Awe, another voice broke in. It's work for us all. How else will we become fishermen and warriors? How else will we feed our families and keep the tribe alive? True. Hikueru is too poor. There are only the fish from the sea. A man must be fearless to provide food. We will all go, every one of us. Mafatu, standing tense in the shadows, heard a scornful laugh. His heart contracted. Not all of us will go, he heard Kana scoff. Not Mafatu. Ha! He is afraid. He makes good spears, offered Viri generously. Oh, that is woman's work. Mafatu is afraid of the sea. He will never be a warrior. Kana laughed again, and the scorn of his voice was like a spear thrust through Mafatu's heart. Awe, Kana was saying. I have tried to be friendly with him, but he is good only for making spears. Mafatu is a coward. The boys disappeared down the moonlit beach. Their laughter floated back on the night air. Mafatu stood quite still. Kana had spoken. He had voiced, once for all, the feeling of the tribe. Mafatu, stout heart, was a coward. He was the boy who was afraid. His hands were damp and cold. His nails dug into his palms. Suddenly, a fierce resentment stormed through him. He knew in that instant what he must do. He must prove his courage to himself and to the others, or he could no longer live in their midst. He must face Moana, the sea god, face him and conquer him. He must. The boy stood there, taut as a drawn arrow, awaiting its release. Off to the south somewhere, there were other islands. He drew a deep breath. If he could win his way to a distant island, he could make a place for himself among strangers. And he would never return to Hikueru until he should have proven himself. He would come back with his head high held in pride, and he would hear his father say, Here is my son, Stoutheart, a brave name for a brave boy. Standing there with clenched fists, Mafatu knew a smarting on his eyelids and shut his eyes tight and sank his teeth into his lower lip. Far off in the Himene house, the old ones were singing. Their voices filled the night with rich sound. They sang of long voyages in open canoes, of hunger and thirst and battle. They sang the deeds of heroes. The hair on the boy's damp forehead stirred. The long-drawn mutter of the reef sounded its note of warning in his ears. At his side, Uri touched his master's hand with a cold nose. Mafatu pulled the dog close. We're going away, Uri, he whispered fiercely. Off to the south, there are other islands. The outrigger canoes lay drawn up on the beach like long, slim fish. Silent as a shadow, the boy crossed the sand. His heart was hammering in his throat. Into the nearest canoe, he flung half a dozen green drinking nuts, his fish spear. He gave his pareu a brave hitch. Then he picked up a paddle and called to Uri. The dog leaped into the bow. There was only Kivi. Mafatu would miss his albatross. He scanned the dark sky for sight of the bird, then gave it up and turned away. The lagoon was as untroubled as a mirror. Upon its black face, the stars lay tracks of fire. The boy shoved off and climbed into the stern. Noiselessly, he propelled the canoe forward, sending it half a length ahead with each thrust of his paddle. As he drew nearer to the barrier reef, the thunder of the surf increased. The old, familiar dread of it struck at his stomach's pit and made him falter in his paddling. The voices of the old ones were fainter and fainter now. The reef thunder mounted, a long-drawn, hushed yet mighty sound that seemed to have its being not in the air above, but in the very sea beneath. Out beyond lurked a terrifying world of water and wind. Out there lay everything most to be feared. The boy's hands tightened on his paddle. Behind him lay safety, security from the sea. What matter if they jeered? For a second, he almost turned back. Then he heard Kana's voice once more saying, "Mafatu is a coward." The canoe entered the race formed by the ebbing tide. It caught up the small craft in its churn, swept it forward like a chip on a mill race. No turning back now. The boy was aware of a sudden whir and fury in the sky above, a beat of mighty wings. Startled, he glanced upward. There was Kivi, his albatross. Mafatu's heart lifted. The bird circled slowly in the moonlight, its wings edged with silver. It hovered for a moment just over the bow of the canoe. Then it rose easily, lightly in its effortless flight. Out through the passage in the reef, out into the open ocean. Mafatu gripped the steering paddle and followed. Chapter 2. The Sea. Day broke over a gray and dismal world. The canoe lifted and fell idly on the glassy swells. Mafatu looked back over his shoulder, searching the horizon for a last glimpse of Hikueru. But the atoll had vanished, as if to hide itself forever from his concern. The matting sail slatted uselessly. But there seemed to be no need of a sail. The little canoe was riding one of the mysterious ocean currents that flow in their courses through the length and breadth of the Pacific. The Aramoana, paths of the sea, as the ancients called them. They were the ocean currents that had carried the Polynesian navigators from island to island in the childhood of the world. Mafatu was drifting farther and farther away from his homeland. With wide flapping wings, Kivi rose from the bow of the canoe. In ascending spirals, the bird climbed higher and higher, until at last he was no more than a gray speck against the lighter gray of the sky. Mafatu watched his albatross disappear, and felt a desolation flood his heart. Now there was only Uri to keep him company in this hostile world of sky and sea. Uri. The yellow dog lay curled up in the shadow of the bow, opening one eye from time to time to look at his master. Wherever Mafatu went, Uri too would go. All around, as far as the eye could reach, were wastes of leaden water. The canoe was the moving center of a limitless circle of sea. The boy shuddered. His fingers gripped the paddle convulsively. He thought of Kana and the other boys. What would they say when they learned that he had disappeared? And Devananui. Would there be sorrow in his father's heart? Would he believe that Moana, the sea god, had claimed his son at last? It was an ominous, oppressive world at this season of storm. Half a mile distant, a whale heaved its varnished hulk to the surface to throw a jet of vapory mist high into the air. Then it submerged, leaving scarcely a ripple to mark its passage. A shoal of flying fishes broke water, skimming away in a silver shimmer of flight. A dolphin sped after them, smooth rolling in pursuit, so close that the boy could hear the sound of its breathing. This world of the sea was ruled by nature's harsh law of survival. Mafatu knew the sea with an intimacy given to few. He had seen fleets of giant mantas whipping the lagoon of Hikueru to a boiling fury. He had seen the mighty cachalot set upon by killer whales and torn to ribbons almost in the blink of an eye. Once he had seen an octopus as large as the trunk of a tamanu, with tentacles 30 feet long, rise from the mild deep water beyond the barrier reef. Aye, this sea. Mafatu opened one of the green drinking nuts and tilted back his head to let the cool liquid trickle down his parched throat. More refreshing than spring water, cool on the hottest days, and as sustaining as food. The boy scooped out the gelatinous meat for Uri, and the dog ate it gratefully. The ocean current which held the canoe in its grip seemed to have quickened. There was a wind rising, too, in little puffs and gusts. Now the canoe heeled over under the sudden attack, while Mafatu scrambled onto the outrigger to lend his weight for ballast. Then the wind dropped as suddenly as it appeared, while the canoe righted itself and the boy breathed freely once again. He searched the skies for Kivi. His albatross might have been one of 1,000 seabirds flying against the roof of the sky, or he might have vanished utterly, leaving his friends here in solitary space. The bird had led Mafatu out through the reef passage at Hiku'eru into the open ocean, and now it seemed had deserted him. A storm was making, moving in out of those mysterious belts which lie north and south of the equator, the home of hurricanes. The wind shifted a point, bringing with it a heavy squall. Mafatu lowered the sail on the run and gripped the steering paddle with hands that showed white at the knuckles. All around him now was a world of tumbling water, gray in the hollows, greenish on the slopes. The wind tore off the combing crests and flung the spray at the sky. Like advance scouts of an oncoming army, wind gusts moved down upon the canoe, struck at it savagely. So busy was Mafatu with the paddle that there was no time for thought. He called a prayer to Maui, god of the fishermen. Maui ai, Mataitu! Somehow the sound of his own voice reassured him. Uri lifted his head, cocked his ears, thumped his tail for a second. The canoe rose to the swells as lightly as a gull and coasted like a sled down the frothing slopes. What skill had wrought this small canoe? This dugout, hewn from the mighty tamanu tree. It swooped and yielded, bucked and scudded, one with the fierce element whose back it rode. The sky darkened. A burst of lightning lit up the sea with supernatural brilliance. An instantaneous crack of thunder shattered the world. Lightning again, striking at the hissing water. Mafatu watched it with fascinated eyes. Now it was all about him. It ran to the end of the boom in globes of fire that exploded and vanished, and in the awful moment of its being, it revealed mountain shapes of dark water heaving, shouldering. How long could this frail craft of wood and sennit resist? Under the combined attack of wind and sea, it seemed that something must inevitably give way. The wind shrilled a fiercer note. Spray stung the boy's flesh, blinded his eyes, chilled his marrow. The sail went first, with a split and a roar. Fragments swept off on the back of the wind. The cords that held the mast hummed like plucked wires. Then, with a rending groan, the mast cracked. Before Mafatu could leap to cut it clear, it snapped off and disappeared in a churn of black water. The boy clung to the paddle, fighting to keep his canoe from turning broadside. Water swept aboard and out again. Only the buoyancy of tamanu kept the craft afloat. Uri cowered in the bow, half-submerged, his howls drowned by the roar of the elements. Mafatu gripped his paddle for very life, an unreasoning terror powering his arms. This sea that he had always feared was rising to claim him just as it had claimed his mother. How rightly he had feared it. Moana, the sea god, had been biding his time. Some day, Mafatu, I will claim you. The boy lost all sense of time's passage. Every nerve became dulled by tumult. The wind howled above his head, and still Mafatu clung to the lashed steering paddle. Clung fast, long after strength had vanished, and only the will to live locked his strong fingers about the shaft. Even death would not loose the grip of those fingers. He held his little craft true to the wind. There was a wave lifting before the canoe. Many the boy had seen, but this was a giant. A monster livid and hungry. Higher, higher it rose until it seemed that it must scrape at the low-hanging clouds. Its crest heaved over with a vast sigh. The boy saw it coming. He tried to cry out. No sound issued from his throat. Suddenly the wave was upon him. Down it crashed. Chaos! Mafatu felt the paddle torn from his hands, thunder in his ears, water strangling him. terror in his soul. The canoe slewed round into the trough. The boy flung himself forward, wound his arms about the midthwart. It was the end of a world. The wave passed. Stunned, gasping, Mafatu raised his head and looked about. For a second, he could not believe that he still breathed and had being. He saw Uri wedged under the bow, choking for air. He pulled the dog free. Then he saw that his string of drinking nuts had vanished. His fish spear was gone. The knife that hung about his neck by a twist of bark had been torn away. Even his pareu fiber tapa fell from his body as water soaked it through. He was naked, defenseless, without food or weapon, hurled forward on the breath of the hurricane. Numb of all feeling, empty as a shell, still he clung to life, and the hours droned by. So gradual was the storm's easing that at first the boy was unaware of it. The wind was blowing itself out, moving off into the empty spaces of the world. Uri crept toward the prostrate boy, quailing beside him, whimpering softly. Night came and passed. There was no morning mist to dim the splendor of the sunburst across the swinging seas. Far away, the wings of an albatross caught its gold as it wheeled and planed against the roof of heaven. The only hint of recent storm lay in the rough and tumbling waters. As the sun climbed through the hot hours of morning, it burned into the boy's body like the sacred fires of the great mare of Hikueru. Mafatu's skin blistered and cracked. His tongue swelled in his throat. He tried to call out a prayer to Maui, but his voice was thick. The sounds which came forth were no more than a hoarse cry. The canoe, stripped of sail and mast, without a paddle to guide it in the swift racing current, twisted and shifted in the rushing waters. As one hour merged into another, there came moments of fitful, choking slumber, a growing agony of thirst for the boy and his dog. The sun burned into them like an inescapable eye. The current which held Mafatu's canoe fast in its grip was bearing it swiftly on toward its mysterious destination. And thus the day passed, while night once more descended, bringing blessed release from the sun. Now the air was luminous with promise of another day. Out of the sultry mists, the sea emerged, blue and violent. With the coming of this new day, terror raised its head. Mafatu tried to fight it back, to deny its existence, but it gripped his heart with clammy fingers, tightened his throat. He flung himself flat on the floor of the canoe and buried his face in his arms. He must have cried out then. His voice was but a hoarse croak, yet it stirred Uri to life. The dog's ragged tail gave one feeble thump. With the ghost of a whimper, the animal laid his hot nose against the boy's hand. The brave thump of his dog's tail touched Mafatu profoundly. He caught the animal to him, while a new assurance, a new strength flooded his being. If Uri could have courage to die, surely he, Mafatu, could not do less. In that instant, he heard a whir and fury in the sky above, a beat of wide wings. Looking upward, the boy's dulled eyes made out the widespread wings of an albatross circling above the canoe. "Kivi!" Mafatu cried hoarsely. "Ai, Kivi!" Even as he spoke, the bird wheeled slowly, then flew off, straight ahead for the distant horizon. The boy noticed then that the sea current was carrying him almost due southwest. Kivi's flight moved in exact parallel. Once more it seemed as if his albatross were leading him onward, just as he had led the canoe out of the passage of Hikueru. Mafatu scanned the rim of the horizon. It looked as hard as the cut edge of a stone. But suddenly, the boy's heart gave a great leap, and he started forward. It couldn't be. It was a cloud. But the sky was cloudless. Far off in the sea shimmer lay something that was neither sea nor sky. The swells lifting higher now revealed, now concealed it. That shadow on the horizon, it was land. The boy flung himself forward, shaking uncontrollably. He seized Uri in his arms and lifted him up, laughing, crying, "Uri, Uri, it's land, land!" The dog sniffed at the air and a little whimper broke from him. What island could this be? Was it Tahiti, the golden island whose language was akin to that of Hikueru? Or was it perhaps one of the terrible dark islands of the eaters of men? Now the current had a westward drift, and it was to the west that the dark islands lay. All day, as the canoe drifted onward, the boy watched the distant shadow shape of land, not daring to take his eyes from it, lest it vanish into the sea. Hunger and thirst were lulled into forgetfulness. There was only this one reality: land, escape from the sea. Weak as he was, he still clung to the thwart, his lips whispering a silent prayer of gratitude. With waning afternoon, the island took more distinct form as the canoe drifted nearer. It was high and peaked, its valleys blue-shadowed against the paler tone of the sky. Hour by hour, with every lift of the swells, the island rose higher and higher, filling Mafatu's soul with wonder. Hikueru, the only land he had ever seen, was as flat as his hand. But a great single peak crowned this strange island. Trees rose green and fair, tier upon tier of them from the shoreline into the foothills of the Purple Mountain. Uri had caught the scent of the land now and was quivering with delight. Then, from far off came the first muffled thunder of the reef, the boom of the surf high bursting on the barrier coral. That sound, was it the voice of Moana? "Someday, Mafatu, someday." Involuntarily, the boy shuddered. Would his ears never be free of the sea god's threat? Mafatu was powerless to guide his craft. He sensed that the current had quickened. He could only watch helplessly as the little canoe, swift as the following gulls, rushed to meet the tides of the island where they met and churned in a cross sea of conflict. Now across the swells came a sound like a chorus of ghostly fishermen weary with their day's toil. Seabirds, always complaining, never at rest. While softer, yet rising above it was another sound. The voice of the reef itself, quieting with sundown, like the reassuring hush of a mother to her child. Night stole up from the face of the sea, enveloping the world. There was no moon, but the black sky was spangled with unguessed millions of stars, other worlds, other suns. To the watching boy, with land in the offing, they seemed closer and more friendly. The bottom star of the Southern Cross pointed to the end of the world. A soft land breeze, heavy with the scent of flowers, wafted out across the dark waters, tantalizing, bittersweet. Weak with thirst, the boy drifted now into a merciful sleep. He struggled against it, like a weary swimmer fighting a riptide, but his head drooped and his eyes closed. He was aroused at midnight by a thunderous tumult in his ears. Of a sudden, he felt the canoe under him lifted and flung high into the air. Then down it crashed into splinters upon the reef. Boy and dog were hurled headlong into the boiling surf. The shock of cold water brought Mafatu half back to consciousness. Blindly, he struck out, fighting for survival. Uri, where was he? No sign of the dog. The boy was aware that the canoe must have been flung over the barrier reef, for here the water was scarcely troubled by wind or tide. Now he was swimming, swimming. Somewhere ahead, a strip of beach, salt white in the darkness, lured him onward. His muscles did it of themselves, only a will to live. A strip of sand white in the night. He caught the gleam of a shark's belly close at hand, but on he swam. His unhampered limbs moved freely through the water. Of a sudden, there was something solid beneath his feet. Sand. Mafatu stumbled, staggered, fell to his knees in the shallows. His lips moved in dry, soundless speech. Lying there with the water rippling and breaking over him, he pulled himself half upright, swayed onward. The palms, trooping to the edge of the beach, were motionless in the night air. All the world seemed to hold its breath as this boy climbed up out of the sea. He fell to the sand once more. Then, guided by he knew not what impulse, he dragged himself to the edge of the jungle. A murmur of water reached his ears, soft as a chuckle of pleasant laughter. Water, sweet water. Down the face of an age-worn rock, a small cascade lost itself amid ferns and cool mosses. A ragged, strangling cry broke from Mafatu's throat. He stood upright to full height. Then he crashed to the mossy bank. One cheek lay in the cool water. The moon lifted above the rim of the palms. It outlined in silver the form of a boy, thin with hunger, naked as the day star. It revealed a small, wet dog dragging himself across the beach to his master's side. Mafatu lay without moving. Before Uri drank, he touched the boy's cheek with his hot muzzle. Chapter 3. The Island. There was a fan of light spreading in the east. Mafatu stirred and opened his eyes. For a moment he lay there motionless in the cool mosses, forgetful of the events which had cast him up on this strange shore. Then it all came crowding back upon him, and he scarcely dared to believe that there was earth, solid earth, beneath him, that once more Moana, the sea god, had been cheated. He struggled to sit upright, then fell back upon one elbow. Uri lay close at hand, holding a robber crab in his forepaws, cracking the tough shell and extracting the meat with gusto. There was Kivi, too, with his beak tucked back under his wing in sleep. Kivi, who had led his friends to this island. Mafatu pulled himself to a sitting position. The action called for more strength than he realized. He was giddy with thirst, and there was an odd weakness in his limbs. His right leg was swollen and painful. He remembered then that he had banged it against the coral when the canoe struck. He discovered that there was a gash on his calf. He must take care of it, for coral wounds were poisonous. The chuckle of the cascade reached his ears and made him aware of a stabbing need of water. He plunged his face into the pool and drank deeply. Then, prompted more by instinct than by conscious thought, he withdrew to let the water run down his swollen throat sparingly, with caution. Its cool magic stole through his tissues, bringing with it new life and restoring force. He sighed and sank back on the mossy bank, relishing the strength that quickened his tired body. Soon he must find food. There were thousands of coconut trees on every hand, rich with green fruit, but Mafatu was not yet strong enough to climb. Later he would try it. Then he would make fire, too, and he must search the island to find out if it were inhabited, and there was a shelter to build. Oh, there was much to do. He hardly knew where to begin. But now it was enough just to lie there and feel strength returning, to know that he was safe from the sea. The sea. He shuddered. Maui, god of the fishermen, had carried him safely across the ocean currents. Uri, the boy muttered thickly. We're alive. It wasn't all a bad dream. It really happened. The answering wag of his dog's tail was further assurance of reality. As Mafatu's brain cleared of cobwebs, a sudden thought brought him up swiftly. This silent island was not Tahiti. What island was it, then? Did it belong to the black eaters of men? Were they even now watching him from secret places in the jungle, biding their time? He glanced about in apprehension. But the solitude was unbroken, save for the soft cooing of ghost terns and the gentle plash of the cascade. On his left hand, far offshore, the reef boomed to the changing surf. The curve of the beach reached out like two great arms to enclose the lagoon. Coconuts and pandanus trooped in shining legions to the very edge of the sea. A flight of green and purple parakeets flashed across the sky and vanished. There was no other sign of life. No voices of men. No laughter of children. No footprint in the sand. The volcanic peak that formed the background of the island rose perhaps 3,000 feet straight up out of the sea. It was the cone of a volcano long extinct. From its base, ridges of congealed lava flowed down to the distant shore. Once, in the dim beginnings of the world, this mountain had belched forth fire and brimstone, spreading destruction over the land. But the forgiving jungle, through fertile centuries, had crept back up the slopes, clothing them in green, green. The boy rose and stood, stretching his stiff limbs. The water had restored him, and he felt much stronger. But he found that the earth heaved with the sea's own motion, and he swayed to keep his balance. His legs still pained, and he would need the juice of limes to cauterize the coral wound, and parau leaves to make a healing bandage. Nearby was a tree loaded with wild limes. He plucked half a dozen of the fruits, broke them on a bit of coral, and squeezed the juice into the wound. He winced as the caustic stung, but when he had bound on the leafy bandage with a twist of vine, it seemed that already his leg felt better. Soon the swelling would be gone. Close at hand, he discovered a rude trail made by wild pigs and goats in their wanderings across the mountain. The trail led up through the foothills to a high plateau which, the boy decided, would make a splendid lookout. From that point of vantage, he would be able to survey his entire island and the sea for a distance of many miles. He followed the path where it led back into the jungle, along the course of the swift-flowing stream. The trail sloped up sharply, and Mafatu pulled himself up by roots and trailing lianas, now climbing, now crawling flat on his stomach. He found that he had to stop every now and then to catch his breath. Uri ran beside him, dashing off on this scent and that. The dog's shrill, sharp bark shattered the morning stillness. For a quarter of a mile, the coconuts held, beautiful trees that were more luxuriant than any in Hikueru. It was always thus in the rich soil of the volcanic islands. Then came a belt of breadfruit and wild bananas, of oranges and guavas and mangoes. The roots of the mape trees, the island chestnut, twisted over the ground in strange, tormented shapes. Vines trailed like aerial ropes from the high branches where orchids bloomed, while little parakeets fled on swift wings and vanished in the green gloom. Mafatu had never before seen woods like these, for Hikueru was open and windswept. These endless legions of trees seemed to close in upon him, imprison him with reaching arms, with heady odors, with eerie light and shadow. Ferns grew higher than a tall man's head. The roof of leaves was powdered with starry blossoms. By the time Mafatu reached the plateau, he was exhausted and his leg throbbed with pain. He lay down full length upon the volcanic rock and watched wild goats leaping from peak to peak high above his head and heard their shrill bleating in the clear air. When he caught his breath, he sat up again and looked about. The plateau appeared to divide the island into halves. From his vantage point, the boy could see its whole circumference. He was hoping desperately for some sign of human habitation, yet fearing it too, for who knew whether humans might prove friends or enemies. He almost hoped that the island were uninhabited, but if it were, he shivered as he realized his isolation. Even at sea in his small canoe, he had not felt so utterly alone as he did here on this strange high island. Everything about it was alien and forbidding. He stood there looking off to the southwest, and all at once his heart gave a jump and he strained forward. A cone shape, vague as a cloud upon the horizon, showed him the existence of another high island. It must have been 50 miles distant. As the boy watched eagerly, scarcely daring to believe the testimony of his eyes, he saw what might have been a column of smoke lifting high into the air from the peak of the cone. He had heard Grandfather Ru'au tell of the Smoking Islands, the home of savage tribes. They were the dark islands of the eaters of men. Was that distant island one such? Perhaps this very island upon which he stood belonged to them too. It was a terrible thought. As he stood there surveying his world, the wind that swept up from the wide Pacific beat hard against him, whistling in his ears. Almost he had to lean against it to keep his balance. It was a southwest wind that blew straight from the Smoking Island, whipping the sea to anger. Inside the barrier reef, the water deepened and shoaled in changing hues. Up here, the whole world seemed consumed with light and color. Far off, a mist of gulls drifted above the breaking surf, their hoarse cries as unceasing as the hum within a shell. Towering above Mafatu's head, the basalt cone of this island looked as soft in hue as an amethyst, broken and worn by 1,000 years of wind and storm. He observed that the barrier reef encircled the entire island. There were only 2 openings in the reef through which canoes might enter. One opening lay on the side of the island where Mafatu had been cast ashore. The other was here to the southwest, facing the distant Smoking Island. In each case, the opening was caused by a river which flowed from the mountain down into the lagoon, for the tiny coral polyp which builds up its ramparts from the floor of the sea cannot withstand fresh water. Wherever a river flows into the sea, there will be a breach in the barrier reef. Mafatu jumped in alarm as a wild boar crashed through the undergrowth. It was so close that the boy caught a glimpse of its dark hide. Uri leaped in pursuit, barking furiously. Mafatu relaxed and a smile crossed his face. Pig roasted underground in the hot oven stones of the umu. Ow, eh. His mouth watered at the golden prospect. He would make a spear and kill the pua. That's what he would do. He was fired with excitement and set for the adventure. Then the thought of killing a wild boar in single-handed combat struck him dumb with wonder. Why, he would never have dreamed of such a thing in Hikueru. He was Mafatu, the boy who was afraid. He set his jaw with fierce resolution. He had never known a man who killed a wild pig. But Grandfather Ruau, who had traveled as far as distant Tahiti, had told how the warriors of that island killed pigs in the mountains with naught but a knife for a weapon, bracing themselves so that the animal impaled itself upon the blade. It needed a strong arm and a stouter heart. Could he, Mafatu, ever accomplish such a feat? Grandfather brought back with him a necklace made from the curling tusks of the boar, and Mafatu could remember to this day how the dark blue scrolls of tattooing on the old man's copper flesh set off the handsome ivory teeth. That necklace was the envy of every man in Hikueru, and its possession earned Grandfather much respect. "I will make such a necklace for myself from the tusks," the boy promised bravely. "And when I return to Hikueru, men will look up to me and say, 'There goes Mafatu. He killed the wild boar single-handed.' And Tavananui, my father, will be filled with pride." The prospect of returning home set another train of thought in motion. "I must find a tree, a tamanu, for my canoe," the boy said aloud. "I will burn it out, then make an adze of basalt to finish it. I'll plait a sail of pandanus, and oh, it will be a wonderful canoe." At that moment his eye fell upon a mango tree loaded with juicy fruit, and he plucked a fruit and sank his teeth into the rosy pulp. For a few seconds while he ate his fill and the juices ran down over his chin, he forgot all about his canoe, forgot that he needed shelter, food, fire, and weapons. Then, his hunger satisfied, his mind ran ahead again to the happy day when he would set sail for Hikueru, with all his demons put to rout, and the bright flame of courage burning in his heart. Never again would he be called Mafatu, the boy who was afraid. He stood there, taut with purpose, high above the demon sea. "Maui, God of the fishermen, hear me," he pleaded. "I shall return home one day, I swear it. My father, Tavananui, will be filled with pride at my homecoming. It is a vow that I take now, O Maui. I have spoken." The wind from the sea swept up around him, its voice warm and soft and reassuring in his ear. Maui, God of the fishermen, had heard and answered. Mafatu decided that before he retraced his steps to his own beach, he would explore the opposite side of the island. The trail dropped from the plateau in a series of swift turns and spirals. The boy clambered down, slipping and sliding, catching hold of roots and vines to keep from falling. Far below, a cool, dark stream wound its way through a sheltered valley. Perhaps in that valley he would find some people. At the base of the ancient crater, long ridges of lava descended to the valley. Of a sudden, Mafatu remembered an old tale out of his childhood. He had been told how the youths of Tahiti slid down the lava slide on sleds of giant leaves. The thought had scarcely struck him before he was wrenching off half a dozen great leaves from a nearby banana tree. Even as he did so, he stopped, suddenly alert. They were splendid trees, three times his own height, with broad leaves that waved in the wind like tattered banners. But what caught and held his attention were the stems where fruit had grown. They had been severed cleanly by a knife. His heart gave a great thump and hung fire. He examined the stems with care. Tree after tree had been stripped of fruit, and within a week, too. Who had cut these bananas? Well, he would have to find out. His lips were grim as he set about making his sled. He bound the leaves together with a fibrous rope of vines and soon had a toboggan as long as his body. When Mafatu reached the lava slide, he set his sled in place and flung himself down upon it. With a shout and a shove, he was off. Down the natural slide he sped at terrifying speed. Trees whizzed past. Wind drove the air from his nostrils. The valley rushed to meet him. He brought up with a bump in a thicket of cassie. As he extricated himself from the thorns, he was still breathing with excitement. Owe, but that was fun. He did not stop to think how he would regain his plateau, for at that moment his eye fell upon a broad, well-defined path leading down through the jungle. Ay-ah, he exclaimed. This fine trail was never made by the feet of wild pigs. The boy stood there, irresolute and uncertain. Some premonition of danger kept him poised, alert, and wary. He was half tempted to retrace his way and explore no further. Then an overpowering desire to know who had made that path urged him onward. The trail led toward the sea, widening as it went. Soon it opened into a cleared circle some 100 feet in circumference. Involuntarily, Mafatu started forward, then drew back with a sharp cry. What he beheld filled him with awe, and it set him trembling. He saw a series of wide stone terraces rising in a pyramid many feet high. On top of this pyramid, a grotesque idol, hideously ugly, reared in the brilliant sunshine. It was an ancient idol, its contours softened with fungus and lichens, corroded by the rains of ages. The roots of convolvulus writhed about its base. No wind reached this hidden circle, and insects hummed in the hot air. Mafatu felt that he was stifling. His heart pounded. A marae, a sacred place. Scarcely daring to breathe, he advanced a step. Then he drew up short. Around the base of the idol, he saw piles of bones, charred but not old. The platform was strewn with them. Bones too large for dogs, too large for pigs. And then Mafatu understood. His heart congealed. This was a Motu Tabu, a forbidden island. Here the eaters of men made their terrible sacrifices to the Varua Ino. Mafatu stood rooted, unable to advance, powerless to flee. Uri slunk at his side, growling low, the hair on his neck lifting stiffly. Involuntarily, the boy looked up. Through an opening in the trees, the cloud cone of Smoking Island floated on a wine-colored sea. Could that distant island be the home of the savages who used this Motu Tabu for their place of sacrifice? Was it here that they came in their black canoes to turn the night hideous with their drums and ceremonies and leaping fires? Mafatu shivered. He had believed that Maui, god of the fishermen, had led him safe to this island. But perhaps, after all, it had been only a cruel prank of Moana, the sea god, angry at having been cheated. The boy seemed to hear Moana saying, "Someday, someday, Mafatu, I will claim you." It was evident that the savages had been here recently, for the piles of ashes rested undisturbed by wind and storm. The cleared circle seemed to hold its breath, locked in a supernatural silence. As the boy paused, irresolute, looking up at the towering marae, his eye was caught and held by a gleam of light, and his heart gave a mighty leap, for he saw that a spearhead lay on the sacred platform. Finely ground, sharp-edged, a spear for food, a weapon against attack. Dare he take it? It might mean death. His heart pounded. He moved 1 foot forward. His hands were damp and cold. The flashing spearhead winked back at him like an evil eye. The boy's limbs turned to water. For a second, he was powerless to move. In that moment, had a score of black men leaped forth from the jungle, he could not have stirred or cried. He fought himself for control. Taking a deep breath, he whispered, "It is you, Maui, who have led me to this island. I know it. Do not forsake me now." Almost it seemed as if he could see dark shadows moving among the ferns and hear the phantom whisper of voices. But he edged forward, poised for instant flight. There, he was so close to the idol that he could have touched it. He reached out his hand. It took every ounce of will. The spearhead glistened brightly. His fingers closed about it, tightened. The towering idol cast a shadow of darkness across the green earth. Quickly, the boy drew the spearhead toward him. But in moving it, he dislodged a bone. It fell at his feet. Its touch was deathly cold. Mafatu gasped. Then he whipped about and was running, running. But he still gripped the spearhead in his fist. He scrambled back up the path once he had come. His heart was hammering, his legs stiff and sore. The twisted roots of the mape trees reached for him as he fled. Never had they seemed so much like grasping fingers. The giant tree ferns turned the jungle to an eerie gloom. The boy was filled with unaccountable dread. His limbs seemed weighted. When at last he reached the base of the lava slide, he turned at right angles and fought his way upward, hauling, pulling himself by vines. At last he gained the plateau, drew up breathless and panting. The spear flashed in his hand. He looked down at it in wonder. Nothing had happened to him. He had touched the marais, dislodged a bone on the place taboo, yet still he lived. The sun shone, the sky arched blue. Nothing was changed. And this spear, aloe, but it was a beautiful one. It was worth all the risk. Those eaters of men had wrought well. Now he, Mafatu, could kill the wild pig. Now he could defend himself against attack. But most important of all, he knew that he had won a great victory over himself. He had forced himself to do something that he dreaded, something that took every ounce of his will. The taste of victory salted his lips. He threw out his chest and cried, "It is you, Maui, who have helped me. My thanks to you." Uri leaped and pranced with excitement at his master's side. Back once more at his own shelter, Mafatu kept looking and looking at the spear. Happiness flooded through him in warm tides. It was not so much the possession of a spear. No, it was the fact that he had touched the mare. That took courage. Aye, courage. And as he set about searching for a fire stick, he sang a song at the top of his young lungs. It was a brave song of Ta'aroa, the hero god who rose out of the sea to slay the enemies of his people. Ta'aroa po'ai'i, hitira no te moana, haroa te po'ai'i ai'o, ta'aroa'e. His voice rose clear and strong across the jungle stillness. Seabirds and parakeets hushed their cries to listen to the strange, intruding sound. At last, Mafatu found a fire stick to his liking, a piece of hard wood, bone dry, as large around as his forearm. Then he searched for a smaller piece of the same wood. Propping the larger piece against a rock, he squatted on his haunches before it and gripped the small sliver in both hands. He began to move it back and forth upon the hard surface. A groove commenced to form. A little pile of wood dust gathered at one extremity of the groove. Now the boy's hands were moving faster and faster. Back and forth they flew, while perspiration stood out on his forehead and his breath came in gasps. At last he was rewarded. A wisp of smoke drifted upward from the wood dust. A glow. The boy seized a few twigs, and cupping his hands with great care, blew upon the spark. A flame burst into life. He had made fire. Weary with the exertion, Mafatu settled back on his haunches and watched the leaping flame. Fire. His arms and back ached unmercifully. The wound in his leg throbbed. But the warm glow of flame comforted him. It made him think of home, of food and warmth and companionship, of faces around the evening circle, of the drone of old men's voices telling their endless tales of daring. And he was swept by a sudden wave of loneliness, a longing for the sound of his father's deep voice. He shut his lips tight and fought it back, then leaped to his feet and set about his small tasks with a great show of business. He would not think of those things. He would not remember, if he could help it. Now he would have cooked food, warmth when he was wet through, and the first implement with which to set about building his canoe. Tomorrow he would fell a tree by fire and start to work upon his dugout. He would make fire only by day, and then not too large a blaze, for its glow might be visible on the distant island of the eaters of men. Thus he forced his thoughts into safer channels. He threw breadfruit into the fire. There it would stay until it was charred black and thoroughly cooked. Next he laid half a dozen fei, wild bananas, in the coals, covering them with wet leaves.